Even given that, I'd kill him in a heartbeat if it meant getting Aaron back. Something Shoshana no longer believed. I said, we ran across each other on our last mission. But he's not a friend, and I had no idea he was here. Her eyes lidded, and she said, you fucking liar. And that was enough. I stood, my fists balled, and both Jennifer and Brett jumped up, realizing I was dropping into her world. I leaned into her space, vibrating in anger. You ungrateful bitch. I saved your fucking life. I would give my life for you, and you don't even see it. She lashed out with a fist and caught my chin, a hard snapping blow, throwing my head back. Jennifer jumped between us, but I knew it wasn't necessary. If she had wanted to harm me, she wouldn't have used a punch. I rubbed my jaw and said, you done? She gave another guttural moan, and then drove her fist into the wall, punching through the sheetrock. I said, is the Mossad gonna pay for that? She whirled back at me, and Jennifer ducked out of the way. I said, stop it, now. It's getting a little old. She wound up for more combat, then melted right in front of me, all the anger leaking out, leaving a scared child in its wake. She said,
help me, please, Pike. They have Aaron.
She had never asked for a single thing in her entire life, and her words gutted me, because there was nothing I could do to alleviate the pain. I said, we will, Shoshana. We are. We're trying to unravel the thread right now. Let us check out that warehouse. My target is Tyler, and I need evidence against him to continue. I need to see what's in that warehouse so I can give the task force a plausible reason to continue. You made the key, and we'll use it. Shoshana had proven more innovative than I would have thought, finding a hobby shop with a 3D printer in the time we'd left her. She'd loaded the flash drive into it and had a plastic key created, using the photo she'd taken and the program from the task force. The hobby shop hadn't cared what she was doing, as long as she paid. I saw the dark angel begin to bloom, and she said,
screw the warehouse. Let's go get that fucker Johan. He knows where Aaron is.
I said, we can't do that. We still work inside a construct. Aaron isn't here in Cape Town. We aren't going to save him by running amok. We're going to save him by working the problem. I knew it was bullshit, and the statement itself disgusted me. But I couldn't have her interdict our only thread. She shook her head and said,
that's just more words. We can't wait for that. We need to wrap up the people at that meeting. If not Johan, take out Tyler.
Tyler won't give us Aaron. He's a braggart. And he's my main target. You heard them talk about payment. That wasn't money. That was something else. The task force thinks it knows what it is, but they need to be sure. If I want to continue, I need to build a pattern of activity against him. Not take him out without sanction. All that'll do is get me pulled and Aaron dead. She snatched her purse from the table and said,
I'm not waiting. I told you what would happen when your mission crossed over mine. I'll do it alone.
She started stalking toward the door, and I said, you still have my task force phone? She whirled around, digging into her purse and saying,
you want it back? Fine.
She tossed it onto the table next to the door.
Take the damn thing. I don't need it.
I said, I didn't ask because I wanted it back. I asked because you never fucking use it, although I'd like you to. She stopped but said nothing, waiting. I forged ahead. The guys are talking about a halo jump and training natives. This problem has gotten bigger than the initial mission. I have to see what's going on. I'm required to develop the target. She said,
and do you think America will care about some criminal activity in South Africa? When it doesn't have anything to do with terrorism, why would they let you continue?
I said, let us check out the warehouse and let me worry about selling it. She looked like she was going to attack me again. I held up a hand and said, why don't you go locate our beacon? Instead of peeling Johan or Tyler apart, go take a look at the guy from the meeting, as someone not affiliated with the task force. It took a second for my words to penetrate her head. When they did, I saw the dark angel blossom, and it was scary. Her eyes bored into mine, and everyone in the room ceased to exist except for me and her. she said.
You mean that Nephilim?
Jennifer half rose from her chair, understanding what I was doing. Before she could stop it, I said, yes, for Aaron. I walked over to the table, picked up the task force phone, and handed it to her, saying, Blood, text her the picture of the target you took inside the Long Street Hotel. He did as he was asked. She turned without a word and left. The room was silent for a moment. Then Jennifer said,
Jesus, Pike, she's going to kill that guy.
I leaned against the counter, my hand tapping it unconsciously, wondering if I'd done wrong. I said, Yeah, she might, but we've got nothing else to go on, and the task force won't give a sanction, no matter what we find in that warehouse. We won't see any evidence of nuclear triggers. All we have right now is the mention of a payment.
She said, Pike, we don't work like this. We can't let her do this.
I locked eyes with her and said, Aaron's worth it, no matter what. She looked at Brett, and he nodded, saying, If it were me, I'd want you on my side. Fuck the Oversight Council.
44. Aaron took his small bowl of rice and scuttled out of kicking range of the guards, settling in next to Thomas. Thomas looked at him with a little bit of admonishment, and Aaron knew why. Although he was starving, he knew the price. He duck-walked over to the communal bowl and kicked in his share of rice, then came back to the wall. Thomas said, You don't have to do that, you know. Like Aaron had a choice. He chuckled and said, I know, if I want to die, I can eat that rice. Thomas's face grew stern, irritated at the suggestion. He said, You do what you want when you want. I don't ask anything of you. Aaron said, Yes, you do. Thomas put his bowl on the ground, glanced to make sure the guards were out of earshot, and said, Who are you, really? The question brought a stab of regret. It had been 2 days since General Mosebo had visited, and Aaron knew his time was drawing to a close. The clock was ticking faster and faster. Sooner or later, Mosebo would return, and when he did, Aaron would be faced with a choice. Sacrifice his life in defense of Alex, or simply let them have their way with her. He didn't like the options, because he was sure that no matter what happened, they would have their way with her. He would just be dead. He'd given up hope on Shoshana. Not that he didn't think she was searching for him, but she had nothing to go on. His mind refused to think of the inevitable. They'd killed her. That simply wasn't possible. Still, in a small recess of his soul, the thought grew. And with it, a desire for vengeance. If that was true, then he had no reason to pretend or cover anything he was doing with the Mossad. His loyalty worked as an ingrained thing, but there was a limit. If what he loved had been killed, and the Mossad could have prevented it, then they'd forfeit the right to his soul. He could take the pain and blood for himself. Hell, he'd signed up for it. But if they'd stood by while Shoshana had been hurt, then they'd reap what they sowed. But he still had a problem. Alex was being held, and he had no means to get her out, unless he went full-on crazy, trying to escape. He might not make it, but the action might be heinous enough to draw a press crew, even in this backwater. They would probably kill him, but if it was reported in the news, the world would be different. It might get her an out. Thomas saw his change in demeanor and repeated, Who are you? Aaron said, I'm the man who's going to get out of here. Thomas scoffed and said, You still don't know where you are, do you? There is no out of here. We're inside the military base of the Lesotho Special Forces. You get out of this prison, and you still have to escape the base. It won't happen. Aaron said, Maybe not, but I can promise one thing. I'll get out of this prison. That I know I can do. You asked who I am. I'll return the favor. Who are you? Thomas smiled and said, I'm like you. No reason to be here. Aaron dropped his bowl and said, apparently so. Look, I don't have the energy to continue with this dance. My name is Aaron Bergman. I was hired to find out about illegal diamond trades. I got caught up in something much bigger. That's my story. What's yours? Thomas set his chipped bowl on the ground and said, I'm a political prisoner. Aaron felt a wisp of a smile starting to form, and Thomas held up a hand, saying, I know that's what you would expect me to say, but it's true. I was threatening the lifeblood of the politicians here, and I was removed to this hellhole. Aaron leaned forward and said, Don't hand me that shit. Lesotho isn't Sierra Leone. It's stable, and has been that way for years. Thomas smiled and said, It's stable because of our natural resources. Resources that are being exploited at the expense of the people. Aaron rolled his eyes and Thomas chuckled. Yes, I guess I do sound a bit like Che Guevara, but it's true. Aaron heard his statement and was intrigued. He said, How do you know about Che Guevara? I was never meant to be a politician here. I was destined for greater things. I left home at the age of 21 to attend the University of Chicago on a USAID scholarship. I earned my bachelor's and master's in economics, and then my PhD in international relations from Georgetown. I had my sights set on the world stage, not Lesotho. I had no intention of coming home. Thomas gazed at the wall, lost in thought. Aaron said, So why did you? Thomas shook his head, remembering, perhaps regretting. He said, My nephew left school at the age of 15. He enrolled in one of the local initiation schools. And he died. It was a tragedy. A mess. Initiation school. You mean he left to learn a trade? No. There is a Basotho tradition from a long time ago where the young men leave the villages and head into the mountains for months, learning to be men of the tribe. In the old days, it was just a tribal tradition. In the modern day, it's all about money, sanctioned by the government of Lesotho. It had died out in my generation, only being conducted in the extreme rural areas. After the fall of white rule in South Africa, it regained prominence. Then, with the introduction of AIDS, it became something of a rite of passage that held more than simply becoming a man. My nephew was attending one of these so-called schools and died in the mountains. They refused to bring him to medical care, because the initiation rites are extremely secret. If he'd have lived until the school was over, he could have seen a doctor. He did not. Aaron said, What are these rites about? Hazing? Beatings? No, not at all. That's not what killed him. Truthfully, most of the schools are based on tribal instructions about taking care of family, tribal traditions, and that sort of thing. But one thing they do is circumcise the members. Since HIV has become so prevalent, the population has a misguided notion that circumcision will prevent infection, which is another thing driving the enrollment to these schools. A tribal healer does it with Lord knows what. My nephew bled out. Thomas looked at him with an embarrassed grin. Aaron said nothing. No words came to mind. Thomas waited a bit, and when no derision surfaced, said, So I came home to help the family, then to fight the schools, trying to get some laws in place to ensure the safety of the men, boys, participating. One thing led to another, and I was running for office. His eyes glowed, and Aaron saw the true believer come to the fore. This country has so much going for it, and yet the government steals it all, allowing the population to live in squalor. 1 in 10 houses has fresh water, because we send all of it to South Africa. The dams block the flow for Johannesburg's use, and the villagers still use buckets in a muddy creek. We have mines that produce the biggest gem-quality diamonds on earth, and all that profit goes to private companies outside of Lesotho. We have nothing to show for our richness. Unless you count being the highest per capita nation on earth, infected with HIV. Thomas had worked himself into a little bit of a frenzy, his voice rising with the crescendo of an itinerant preacher. He realized the mistake and quieted down. He said, "You asked me how I got here, and it's pretty simple. I seemed to resonate with the population when I was fighting against the initiation schools. One thing led to another, and I was running for parliament, and I was popular. This was before I understood what running for the government meant. You were either on the inside, or you were an ineffectual flea. I became neither, which made me a problem. General Mosibo was the solution. He worked with the Prime Minister to get me removed from the equation." Aaron nodded, but something didn't ring true. Against his better instincts, given the man and his brood were keeping him alive, he broached it. "So why are you still breathing? Why not just kill you and bury you in a cesspool somewhere?" Thomas smiled and said, "I honestly don't know. I'd like to think it's because I have too much power, even in here. But I know that's not true. They could make me disappear completely, permanently. So why keep me alive? I mean, my family has no idea where I am. I wasn't arrested on charges. There was no publicity. So why keep me alive?" He turned to the lone window and said, "I think it's because they fear me. The people love me, even as they don't know why. And because of it, the government fears making me a martyr. I'm like the Count of Monte Cristo, or the man in the Iron Mask. Someone they should have killed years ago, but did not." Aaron smiled at the references, which a simple criminal from the country of Lesotho would never have heard of. Clearly, the man was what he professed. Thomas returned to Aaron and said, "I think of those pieces of literature daily, fantasizing about them. Someday the government will regret not killing me, just like the man in those books. And then you showed up." Aaron said, "So? Why do I matter?" Thomas smiled, his teeth gleaming in the darkness. "Because, Mr. Death, you're going to make the fantasy real." 45. Tyler barged into the small lobby of his hotel, his head still full of steam from the meeting at the castle. He was brought up short, seeing Stanko Petrov sitting in the lobby. The security man rose at his entrance, meeting him at the bank of elevators. He said, "You don't look pleased. That fuck Armstrong isn't paying until after the mission. That wasn't the deal. You gave them the arms, you should get payment." Tyler said, "They seem to think once we're paid, we won't have any incentive to continue with the transportation agreements." He punched the elevator button with a grim smile and said, "Truthfully, they have a point. If that operation turns into a mess, there's no way I'd risk my aircraft going back in. Now I have no choice. Hassan is not going to be pleased. You still want me to take care of the loose ends, or wait?" "No, Go ahead. They don't matter anymore. But remember, no signs of violence. That's not an issue. The warehouse guy wants to be paid in drugs. I'm meeting him now. He'll get a blissful sleep. The elevator opened, and Tyler put his hand on the door to keep it from closing. What about the Durbin contact? I'll figure it out. He may not be a threat, but if he is, I can fly out there tomorrow. He's looking to get paid as well, so it's not like he'll run from me. Okay. I got a Skype meeting with Hassan. Might as well give him the bad news. Will he still pay? We put in significant time and money for this little adventure. Tyler entered the elevator and removed his hand, saying, "We'll see." The door closed, and he rode alone to the 7th floor. He entered his room, opened his laptop, then opened the Skype app, dialing a grayed-out contact called Raghead Number 1. The Skype bubble gave its distinctive bleeping, but nobody answered. Tyler looked at his watch and disconnected, seeing he was a few minutes early for their pre-planned meeting. He stood, fixed himself a scotch from the minibar, then tried again. This time the screen cleared, revealing an Arabic man with a clean-shaven bald head and a neatly trimmed beard. Tyler smiled and said, "Hassan, good to see you." "And you too, my brother. Give me some good news. Before that, tell me you followed procedures. You're not on any local Wi-Fi in Beirut, right?" "No, no. I'm on the Resistance's phone system. It's secure." Tyler had met Hassan Kantar in Bulgaria long ago. He was one of the many Syrian recruits the CIA brought over to train on small unit tactics before being inserted back into the cauldron that was the Syrian Revolution. Along with others, Tyler had instructed him on the AK-47 and the RPG-7. Back when he was fresh out of the Marines and still doing the grunt-level work. They had somewhat bonded, because Hassan's English was better than that of the rest of the recruits, and because the Syrian was so inquisitive. He spent every lunch and dinner break sitting down with Tyler, asking all manner of questions about the program, how they would be used, and whom they would be fighting, the Syrian regime or ISIS. It was a touchy subject from the beginning, and Tyler had been instructed to avoid it, sticking strictly to the tactical training. The U.S. position was that the men would fight ISIS, but the recruits they'd found most definitely hated the Syrian regime more. It turned out there was a reason for all the questions. The CIA had finally gotten around to vetting Hassan, and they discovered he was Lebanese, not Syrian. And worse than that, he was suspected Hezbollah, the Lebanese terrorist force that was fighting alongside the Syrian regime. He most definitely wasn't a rebel. Hassan was unceremoniously whisked out of Bulgaria and quietly flown back to Syria. The CIA program had been under relentless attack in Congress because of its lack of mission focus and, ironically, poor vetting procedures. There was no way they would let it be known that they'd allowed a potential Hezbollah spy into the training program. Eventually, Tyler had formed his alliance with Stanko and had left the grunt work behind, becoming the primary supplier of arms and ammunition to the Syrian rebel train and equip program. From those beginnings, he'd tentatively branched out, and his first foreign sale not involving the United States was to Lebanon, a small purchase of magazines and ammunition. He was surprised during the negotiations to find his old friend, Hassan Kantar, involved. They'd rekindled their relationship. Him for the inroads into the lucrative Lebanon arms market, and Hassan for... Well, Tyler never looked too closely at that. Tyler turned down the volume of his laptop and said, You're positive the connection is secure?
Yes, yes. Hezbollah built their own communications architecture to prevent the Zionists from penetrating it. And we've gutted the United States' ability to monitor in this country.
In 2011, Hezbollah counterintelligence had managed to penetrate CIA operations, and over a span of months, had not only publicly named U.S. national clandestine agents on broadcast television, but captured, tortured, and killed the entire indigenous network the CIA had built. It was a fait accompli, but even so, Tyler wondered if Hassan was being too complacent. He said, 2011 was a long time ago. They haven't been sitting still. He saw Hassan wave his hand, the action appearing jerky due to the poor Skype connection. Tyler heard, we are fine. Tell me, do you have good news? Here we go, thought Tyler. The problem was that for whatever reason, Hassan had demanded a deadline. He wanted the triggers sooner or not at all. Tyler said, the good news is my contact does have the product. The bad news is I'm going to be delayed in delivery. Hassan frowned and said, how much of a delay? Possibly a week, possibly more. Hassan shook his head and said, that is not good, not good at all. Why? Who cares if the delivery is delayed? What's the rush? Project Circle has been dead for years. You can wait a little bit longer. Tyler and Hassan's relationship had culminated with this deal. 100 Krytron nuclear triggers smuggled from South Africa's Project Circle by way of Israel, to which Hassan was willing to pay $1 million a trigger. Tyler wasn't stupid. He knew that Hezbollah was completely controlled, trained, and funded by Iran. But he simply followed the mantra, see no evil, hear no evil. Had he done a modicum of research, he would have learned that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action against Iran's nuclear ambitions had proceeded on pace, but it had done nothing to lessen Iran's cravings to become a nuclear power. The JCPOA had inspections set to occur soon, which would complicate the transfer, but that was far removed from Tyler's radar. After all, he needed to be able to tell Cohen with a straight face that he wasn't delivering nuclear weapons components to the avowed enemy of Israel. Hassan said, you were supposed to deliver 2 weeks ago. I gave you the original deadline. And you missed it. Now you're going to miss another? Hassan, it's not like we're talking AK ammo here. These triggers aren't growing on trees. It took longer than I thought. Hassan tapped the table, then said, can you deliver worldwide? Bringing them that late to Lebanon may be problematic. Tyler said, where? I don't know. I'll have to confer with my superiors. Perhaps Afghanistan. Or Iraq. Maybe Turkey. It wasn't lost on Tyler that all three countries shared a border with Iran. He said, I can physically, but I don't own the infrastructure on the ground. That was your job in Lebanon. Meaning he was carrying nuclear weapons components. Something that the average customs official would most definitely have an interest in. Hassan waved a hand again and said, let me worry about that. Call me in a week with an update. It might be possible to deliver them here, depending on how late you are. Tyler disconnected, thinking about the ramifications. This ultimate deal was getting harder and harder to execute. Then he thought about the payout. It would be worth it. 46. Shoshana wound her way down Long Street, the stop-and-go traffic causing her to consider abandoning a plan for a drive-by of the hotel first. The street was packed with cars fighting the partygoers, all rowdy and some drunk, the bars and balconies full of patrons shouting and laughing. In between the revelers, like sharks swimming among an unwitting school of fish, she spotted several seedy characters. Furtive, feral teenagers, advertising their purpose like a neon sign to Shoshana. Pickpockets, or worse. She saw the hotel one block up, then an alley to the left. She took it, driving right up against a trash bin, close enough to the wall of the alley that the passenger door wouldn't open. She sat for a minute, mentally tallying where she was in relation to the hotel. She figured she had about 100 meters. She checked her task force phone, first confirming the beacon was still in place, then flipping to the picture Brett had sent, memorizing it. She left her purse, not wanting the aggravation of protecting it, but took a small strip of leather with 2 wooden toggles on each end and a folding blade. She shoved the purse under the driver's seat and exited, running into a teenager in the dim light, high on something. He smiled at her and held out his hand, asking for money. She said, "You want to make a night's wages?" He nodded dumbly. She said, "Watch this car for 30 minutes. When I return, I'll pay you. Don't let anyone mess with it." He nodded like a puppy, saying, "30 minutes? Maybe sooner." She walked away, entering the flow of people on the street. She stayed on the south side of the street, passing by the Long Street Hotel, assessing it for atmospherics. The bottom floor was a bar, which was par for the course on Long Street, the patrons spilling out onto the pavement, which would make her job easier. The noise alone would camouflage her intentions. She was out for information on Aaron, and she would get that currency any way she could. In the end, the man in the room owned his own fate. She wouldn't kill him unless she found him complicit. If he had anything to do with Aaron's disappearance, he would suffer the consequences. All that remained was how painful it would be. She went 50 meters past the hotel, then jogged across the street. She began walking the other way and reached the side entrance to the hotel, a stairwell leading to the second floor, away from the crowds of the bars. She pulled out her phone, checking the task force beacon. She knew the hotel had only 12 rooms, all on the second floor, which would eliminate any three-dimensional problems finding the correct room. She saw the target was in the back, away from Long Street. She turned into the stairwell and saw a Caucasian man at the top of the landing, talking to her target.
"I pulled the car into the same parking lot on the waterfront we'd used earlier in the day, saying, 'Everybody go with the plan?' Brett chuckled and said, 'Yeah, but I'm not sure Coco here can pretend to be on a date with you. Might want to switch to the angry girlfriend ruse.' I looked at her and said, 'You're good, right?' Jennifer was still a little miffed that I let Shoshana go by herself to interrogate the hotel contact. She claimed it was because she was convinced Shoshana was going to torture and kill the guy, something she couldn't tolerate. But underneath, I could tell she was worried for Shoshana's safety, which was a little bit odd, considering Shoshana's skill. But Jennifer had always been protective of her. She said, 'We should have done one, then the other. Check him out, then hit the warehouse. 4-on-1 is better than 1-on-1. She's walking alone now.' I said, 'Jennifer, we have no sanction. She's not task force. Let her work the problem. We've got sanction for continued alpha, which means the warehouse. That's it.' She opened the door and said, 'Like that's ever stopped you.' I exited and said, 'What? Now you want to go off half-cocked?' She said, 'I want to protect the team, period.' 'You mean Aaron?' 'Yes, we need to find him, for her. You're putting Shoshana in danger, and I don't mean her body.' She glanced at Brett, then hissed, 'You're putting what she wants to be in danger.' I said, you aren't going to change who Shoshana is, and she's in no danger. Before she could answer, I cut off the conversation, saying, Brett, we're going to get a beer at that corner bar right before the drawbridge. Give you time to check out the area. We'll go slow, you go fast. The plan was pretty simple. Brett would penetrate the dock area, giving us real-time intelligence on what was there, and early warning. We'd walk up and use Shoshana's key. We'd be in and out in 30 seconds, documenting what we found for the task force. Easy breezy. Brett speed-walked across the street, blending into the crowds out for the nightlife. Jennifer and I took our time, walking slowly hand in hand. We reached the waterfront and the bar, taking stools out front. We ordered a beer and glass of water each, knowing we'd drink the water and leave the beer. It was a travesty, but I had a personal rule about screwing over waitstaff just because we were on a mission. Jennifer said,
You sure Shoshana will be okay?
What do you mean by okay? She won't get hurt, of that I'm sure.
I mean, she's on the edge. We saw that in Haifa. She's not right here. If she kills someone in cold blood, because she's hell-bent on finding Aaron, it'll take her back.
Back where? She's a killer. It's what she does.
It's what she did. We need to find Aaron our way. Show her she doesn't have to be a beast.
I leaned over and took her hands. Jennifer, you can't save every stray dog. Carrie is Carrie. She is what she is.
So you are what you are?
Yes, precisely. That's my point.
But you aren't what you were.
That was dirty pull. Pulling in my past with the implication that I was just one more stray dog she'd saved. Which, unfortunately for my argument, happened to be true. Jennifer, we may be too late to do anything about Aaron. She nodded, knowing what I was saying was true but not wanting to address it. She said,
Shoshana wants to talk to me. She said so, when you were out of the room.
I asked, about what? Jennifer balled up a napkin and tossed it at me. I batted it away, and she said,
About Aaron, relationships, about not killing for a living, and how you keep throwing her back into that life like a damn pimp.
I said, Hey, that's not fair. And my earpiece came alive. Pike, this is blood, it's clear, one guard, but he's making a lap. You got a 10-minute window.
47. Shoshana immediately backed away from the stairwell before the men could focus on her. She retreated to the bar that occupied the first floor, bumping up to a table on the outside patio and waiting for them to pass. A man slapped his hand on her shoulder, causing her to whirl around. He said, Hey, Sheila, you looking for a drink? Two things went through her mind. One, he was Australian. Two, he provided the perfect cover. She reverted back to her time in the Gaza Strip when she hunted men with her body. She said, I'd love one. Scotch, straight up. The man left, and she was accosted by two others, both friends of his. She engaged them in conversation, but kept an eye out off the porch to the alley. She saw her target pass by and moved to follow. One of the friends said, Where are you going? He hasn't even brought the drink back. She said, I'm sorry. You guys have it. The other, clearly drunk, said, That's fucking bullshit, you slash. You can't get him to buy you a drink and then just toss off. She saw the targets getting away and apologized again. The drunk blocked her escape, incensed. She grabbed him by the crotch and the throat, slamming him into the wall, saying, Don't fuck with me. She stared into his eyes, and he wilted. She dropped him to the floor and threw some money on the table. She exited the bar, the Australians lamely shouting insults her way. But none followed. The street was crammed with people, and she'd lost sight of her target. She brought out the task force phone and saw the beacon still inside the hotel room. He'd left it behind. Damn. She started threading through the crowd, moving with an economy of motion she'd learned in the markets of the West Bank. She broke through a gaggle and saw the Caucasian and her target entering a car. She focused on the vehicle, fusing the model, color, and every dent into her brain, then immediately reversed course, running flat out back the way she'd come, back to her car. She rounded the corner to the alley and saw the high teenager sitting on the hood, just like she'd asked. She smiled, unlocking the door. The teenager said, "Hey, it's only been about 10 minutes. You promised to pay for 30. She dug her purse out from under the seat, pulled out a wad of rand that would last for a week, and threw it into the street, saying, "You did good work." He scrambled to pick up the money, and she reversed the car, whipping it hard enough to catch him with the front quarter panel. He flipped over the hood, hitting the ground on the far side. She rolled down the window, shouting, "You okay?" He stood up, holding the wad of cash and smiling. "I guess that was for the last 20 minutes. She rolled out of the alley, forcing her way into the traffic of Long Street, and ignoring the honking. She couldn't make any headway on the two-lane road and prayed the target car was stuck in the same mess. She beat the steering wheel, working into a rage that would consume anyone who approached, when the target car passed her going the other way. She looked as it trailed by, moving 10 miles an hour, her target in the passenger seat, oblivious to the death that was in the opposite lane. When it was passed, she cut across the traffic, causing screaming and honking. She pulled into an alley, did a 3-point turn, and began following, now 4 cars behind. They made a left and rights, leaving the nightlife and passing through the colorful Bokop neighborhood, the narrow alleys bringing her back to the West Bank, and then eventually they started going uphill on a switchback road, leaving all traffic behind. She made a hairpin turn and realized they were headed to Signal Hill, an old naval fortification from the time of sails. The road was a skinny 2-lane affair with houses on the lower part of the slope to her right and rocky hillside to her left. If the target car stopped anywhere on it, she would be forced to continue, as she had no plausible reason to do the same. She decided to back off, letting the car get far enough ahead that all she could make out was the glow of the headlights in the darkness. When she lost the glow, she advanced until she made contact again, driving with only her parking lights. She followed this rule for the next few minutes, starting and stopping, until she crested a small rise. She saw the headlights and pulled over to the side of the road, just as they disappeared again. She began moving forward slowly like she had before, but the lights didn't reappear. She fought the urge to switch on her own headlights, allowing her to drive at speed, when she realized that the car had stopped next to a patch of shanties built onto a level plot of ground on the high side of the hill behind a chain-link fence. Constructed of plywood, discarded tin, and whatever else could be scrounged, it was a mini slum with a plume of smoke coming from somewhere in the back. She pulled over to the side of the road, seeing the dim outline of the car. She wondered about the stop, going back and forth on whether it was worth a penetration, wondering if this was the end game, and whether it was time to turn on her skills. She inched forward in her car for another 100 meters, then killed the engine, just waiting, waiting to see what happened. Eventually, the Caucasian returned to the car, followed by 2 locals. The moonlight was too low to determine if either was her target. The car started, headlights flared, and it drove another couple of 100 meters before stopping again. She pulled out her phone and brought up a map. The icon of her location pulsed less than 200 meters from the noon gun, where tourists came to watch a cannon fire exactly at noon every day. A vestige of the signals given before everyone had a quartz watch or cell phone. She slipped out of her vehicle, deciding to go on foot. She went into the shadow of the woods, steering clear of the shanty town, hearing laughter and shouting from within. She reached the edge of the Noongun Park, seeing a decrepit naval fortification in the moonlight. Old armories built into the dirt, concrete bastions from World War II, and slashes in the earth clad in cement, designed for men to scurry about loading the weapons that no longer existed. She held up, turning her ear to the wind. She heard a fleeting voice, lost as quickly as a wisp of smoke. She crouched in the darkness, cocking her head. She heard it again. She advanced forward, reaching the crest and seeing the entire Table Bay spilled before her down the mountain, a spectacular view. She ignored it, focusing on finding her target. But there was nothing. She waited, closing her eyes and focusing on her hearing, shutting out all other senses. She heard one more scrap of words tangled in the wind. She slinked forward, getting closer and closer to the noise, until she was crawling on a concrete platform that overlooked a sunken walkway between decrepit gun positions, the cement split with weeds. She saw a light and flattened on the ground like a snake. She heard a noise and began slithering forward. She reached the edge and peeked over. In the pit, she saw the Caucasian, along with the two black men. She recognized one as her target. The Caucasian said, "Here's what you want, you and your buddy." He held something in his hand, and she saw the first black man extend his arm. The Caucasian said, "Before you get paid, who have you told about what we're doing? Who knows about the warehouse?" "Nobody, man. You asked for the warehouse, and that's all I did." "You saw the contents. I know you did, and that was a mistake." "Not your mistake, but it was a mistake either way." "Did you tell anyone?" "Nobody. I don't tell nobody." The other man said, "Hey, what the hell are you guys doing? Let's get the juice going. I don't got long. I got to get back." The Caucasian said, "Just a minute. One more minute." Shoshana realized by his accent that he wasn't American. He was from somewhere else. Eastern Europe? The man from the shanty town said, "Fuck that, bro. I sold you the shit. The discount was that I get some. Let's use it." "I paid you." "Wait a minute." The man rolled over and said, "I'm not waiting." He reached for the box between them, and the Caucasian pinned his hand to the concrete, saying, "That's not for you. It's for us." Shoshana's target said, "What the fuck you doing, man?" The Caucasian reached up with his giant paw, placed it against the drug dealer's head, and slammed it into the concrete. The man screamed and rolled away, holding his skull. The target jerked upright, now afraid, saying, "Whoa, whoa, man. No reason to get violent." The Caucasian said, "Sit down. Now." The man did. The Caucasian said, "I need to know. Who did you tell about the shipment?" "Nobody, I told you. I didn't tell nobody." The target's brow began to leak sweat, and the Caucasian broke open the box between them. Shoshana saw a needle. She thought he was about to threaten the man, but then saw his eyes open wide in anticipation. The Caucasian said, "You want to taste this? Yes?" "Yes, please. I did what you asked. You owe me payment." "Tell me who you talked to, you dumb fuck." "I told you. I only talked to the guy in Durban, the one who helped with the Israeli. He's cool." "Come on, man. He's cool. You know that." Shoshana felt a bolt of electricity go through her. It was all she could do not to leap down into the pit. The Caucasian said, "Yeah, he's cool. I'm going to see him tomorrow anyway. Hold out your arm. The target did, and the Caucasian injected the dope into his veins, watching the man's eyes. He relaxed, sagging into the concrete, and the Caucasian turned to the other. He said, "Your turn." The dope seller, still holding his head in pain, realized he was in trouble, but not nearly quick enough to prevent the outcome. He tried to stand, but the Caucasian caught him, flipping him over onto his stomach, the man's arms flailing about ineffectually. The Caucasian reached under his chin and snapped his neck like he was cleaning a chicken. The target saw the action, now caught in the embrace of the drugs. He struggled upright, saying,
"What you doing?"
The Caucasian said, "Ridding the world of vermin." Stupidly, the target said,
"What?"
The Caucasian sprinkled the grounds with drug paraphernalia, then said, "Enjoy your last high." He spit on the ground, then jogged away, running up the stairs, taking them two at a time. Shoshana flattened, and he went by her without even realizing she existed. He disappeared, and she looked back over the wall. The black man mumbled,
"What that mean? What you doing?"
Shoshana realized he'd just killed the target with an overdose. She glanced back, making sure the man was gone, then leapt down into the pit. She checked the first man, finding him dead. She went to the second, seeing him sagging backward, his eyes lidded. She raised him up, and he sluggishly responded. She patted his face and said, "What man in Durban? Who is the man in Durban?"
"What? Who are you?"
She slapped him hard, saying, "Who is the man in Durban?"
"Eshan? My friend Eshan? He's my bruh. He's..."
And he passed out. Shoshana jerked him upright again, saying,
"Don't go, motherfucker. Don't go. Who is Eshan? Wake the fuck up."
His eyes fluttered, and he fumbled at his waist, saying,
"He's my bro. I call him. He knows me. We didn't do anything."
She slapped his hand away, digging into a pocket and pulling out a cell phone. She powered it up, seeing a password screen. She held it in front of his face and saw he was slowly losing his grip on reality. She slapped his face again and said,
"Open this. Show me Eshan."
He brightened for a moment, saying,
"You'll get him here?"
His words were so slurred, she barely understood him. She said,
"Yes. Unlock the phone. I'll get him here."
He sat upright, a small bit of drool forming on his lips. He focused on the phone for a full 10 seconds, Shoshana wanting to punch him in frustration. He finally tapped in a sequence of digits. They failed. She bit her lip and said,
"Again. Do it again."
He did, and it failed again. She slapped his face and got a response. He jerked upright and said,
"You fucking witch! You witch!"
And began to sag again. She grabbed his hair, shaking his head back and forth, and said,
"Do it again."
He tried one more time, and the phone opened. She scrolled through the contacts and found someone named Eshan. She held it up to his face and said,
"Is this Eshan from Durban?"
He said,
"My bro Eshan. He knows I didn't do anything wrong."
She grabbed his shoulders and shook forcefully, saying,
"Is this Eshan from Durban?"
His eyes rolled back into his head, and he was gone.
48. I tossed more rand than was required onto the table, and we left the bar, both beers still full. Unfortunately.
I said, Blood, we're headed your way. What's your location?
I'm sitting on the corner across the street from the turn down to the wharf. You'll have to pass by the wharf road, and you'll see me. I'm on some railway ties.
Got it. We went up the stairs past the mall, going by the cheesy Ripley's Believe It or Not exhibit, then cleared the last of the tourist area. We walked past a parking lot, seeing a spit of land going out into the water, the sparse finger of terrain covered in warehouses, forklifts, and gantry cranes. We continued on, and I heard a hiss. I looked to my right and saw Brett curled up like a homeless derelict, in the shelter of an incredibly ugly concrete building. I went to him, took a knee, and said, No change? No change. I timed the guy. He takes 10 minutes to go down and come back. He starts on one side and returns on the other. And he just went down the front. So you've got about 5 minutes to get in and get out. I nodded and said, Other surveillance? 4 cameras, all on the corners. You leave here and go wide, you'll miss the one on this side. The other one already caught you walking up, though. The warehouse in question was the second to the last on the finger of land jutting out into the harbor. There were 6 of them, and each had no internal security. The security apparatus was dedicated to the entire warehouse facility. The first camera didn't concern me, because it caught everyone walking on the quay. The second, on the other hand, would confirm the first, if looked at after the fact. I said, Jen, you lock down the water side. Brett, you lock down the land side. They both nodded, and I said, Showtime, but remember that the easy missions are the ones that get screwed up. Treat this like we're taking out Bin Laden. We avoided the lens of the far side camera, then closed into the wharf, walking down it like we belonged, which we most certainly did not. Pretending to be on a date did no good here, and Jennifer knew it. She put her hand inside her purse, where I knew a nasty little stiletto resided, and I said, No lethal here. She said, I know, but it's a pretty good intimidator. We passed by the various warehouses and reached our target, a rolling door with a side entrance, a lone bulb illuminating the lock. I nodded at Jennifer, and she continued on, reaching the corner of the warehouse row and taking a knee. I turned my attention to the lock, pulling out Shoshana's 3D key, a bit of solidified plastic with a blob on one end sticking out from the blade. It looked like something a child had made dripping mud on a beach, but the end result mirrored the lock face. At least, I knew it would pass through the key set. I inserted it slowly, not wanting to cause a jam. It went all the way in, the unique sleeve for the secure feature of the lock defeated. I felt its seat and glanced down the wharf, seeing Jennifer scanning the area. She flicked her eyes to me and I nodded, letting her know we were game on. I withdrew the key about 1/8 of an inch, pulled a small rubber mallet from the cargo pocket of my pants, then tapped the key, twisting as soon as it seated. The lock refused to move. I took a breath, slid the key out again, and tapped once more, this time harder. No result. I knew I wasn't hitting it hard enough, but I was worried about the strength of the key, because it was really nothing more than layered plastic. Brett came over my earpiece saying, Are you fucking with me? You got less than 3 minutes to get inside. I do not want to go physical here. I said, I'm working the problem. The lock isn't releasing. We'll get it to release or back off. You've got 2 minutes and counting. I hammered the key again harder than I should have and twisted. I felt the key break inside the lock, but also felt the lock turn free. I said, I'm in. I entered the room, the darkness overpowering, but I could feel the space inside. I closed the door and pulled out a surefire tactical flashlight. It blazed into existence, and I began stabbing the gloom with the sharp blade of light. I saw crate after crate of munitions, a veritable backlot on the set from an 80s action movie. I pulled out my phone and began recording, getting everything I saw in digits. I cracked open one of the crates, seeing a Sig Sauer MCX assault rifle, a true assault rifle, with the ability to deliver selective fire between full automatic and single shot. A weapon that was made to achieve dominance, and not in a cheap way. I took a picture of the serial number and went further, looking for anything that smacked of nuclear devices. I found MC-4 parachutes, Belgian mini-grenades, door-breaching charges, and a ton of ammunition, but no indication that any of it had anything to do with nuclear weapons. Like I expected. I was about to tell the team I was coming out when Jennifer came on. Pike,